Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for joining us for April's Emergency Club webinar. I'm very pleased to introduce you to our speaker for today, RCVS Specialist in Veterinary Emergency and Critical Care, Helen Wilson. Thank you, Helen. I'm now going to hand over to you.
Thank you, Sammy Jo, and welcome everybody to today's webinar. We're going to be talking about CPR and how to get the most out of your team in the event of a CPR. So firstly, I guess we should talk about why CPR is an important thing to be doing. And I mean, obviously, this is an emergency situation and we want to be getting these patients back. But really, we need to treat every crash as important because every crash is a team building exercise. This is a moment in our careers where we all really work together as a team, and the better the team functions, the more likely we are to get these patients back, because this is a situation where a team is working together as one body, really. So the better we are at doing CPR, then the more likely we are to save these critically ill patients. And in CPR, the only things which have been shown to improve outcome are good quality chest compressions, good quality ventilation, and electrical defibrillation if it's needed. Now, the things that we're going to be focusing on today are how to get everybody in the team confident doing good quality chest compressions and ventilation. And don't worry if you don't have an electrical defibrillator in your practice, because as we'll speak about, it's perfectly possible to get around that problem and do a different form of defibrillation if you need to. In a crash situation, it is really important that somebody takes charge and leads the team, because everyone otherwise is sort of unsure as to exactly what's going on. So it's usually best for the most experienced person present to lead the team, but that may very well be an experienced nurse, maybe in some situations even a less experienced nurse, or it may be a junior vet leading the team. So it's important that everybody who may be involved in a crash situation actually feels confident taking the lead in case that job should fall to them. And really, the job of the leader is to organise who in the team is doing what and make sure that everybody understands their role and is performing their role effectively. And so if possible, if there are enough people present, it's best if the leader is not actively participating in the CPR, but they're more standing back and observing everything so that they have a true overview of what's going on. It's also very important that the leader allows everybody who's present during a CPR effort to have chance to give their opinion, and it's good for the leader to solicit opinions from everybody else present, because it may be that one person there knows a pertinent fact about the patient that maybe nobody else knows. So it's good to be asking the team, you know, can anyone think of anything else? Is there anything that we've missed with this patient? And it's also really important to ask the opinion of everybody before stopping CPR as well. So by convention, we would normally perform CPR for 20 minutes. And if we haven't got the patient back after that length of time, then it's reasonable to stop. But it's important to ask everybody if they're comfortable with that decision, in case anybody has any strong feelings that need to be addressed before stopping CPR, so that everybody feels that they're truly a team member of the CPR. It's good, if possible, to employ this technique called closed loop communication. And this has been shown to be very effective in human medicine. And it's a situation where the leader gives an order directly to one person. So it's very easy in a CPR situation for the team leader to just shout out orders such as get the ECG pads on, draw up the atropine, and it's equally easy for everybody who's present to think that somebody else is doing it. And what actually happens is that nobody does it. So it's better for the team leader to directly address one person and say, for example, Sarah, could you put the ECG pads on? Or Sarah, could you draw up the atropine? And then in closed loop communication, the person who has received the order should repeat that back to the team leader to ensure that it's been heard and understood correctly. So if, for example, I've said, Sarah, please could you draw up the atropine? And Sarah repeats back to me, I'm drawing up the adrenaline. Then I know that that's been misheard and I can say, oh no, sorry, that was atropine, not adrenaline. And in human medicine, it's been shown that this dramatically improves outcomes from CPR by reducing medical errors. So this is a really good thing to do, and it takes a little bit of practice because usually everyone feels quite panicked in a CPR situation, and it is much easier to just sort of shout out random orders. But with a little bit of practice, this becomes a really useful and effective way of communicating during CPR. And it shouldn't be underestimated how important it is to have somebody scribing during a CPR effort. And aside from anything else, it's a legal record, so we should have a written record of a CPR event. But also, the person who is scribing is the person who is best placed to keep track of time, because everything goes into a bit of a time warp during CPR, and things can feel like they're moving a lot more slowly than they really are, or equally a lot faster than they really are. So it's good for the scribe to be watching the clock, and they can be directing when the next lot of drugs should be given, when it's important to change over the people doing the chest compressions, as we'll talk about in a bit, and also keeping track of the length of time that the CPR has been going on for, because obviously you don't want to realise that you've been doing CPR for an hour and nobody sort of realised it was going on for so long. It may be that the person who is leading the crash can also be the person scribing, because that puts them in a position where they're slightly stood back from the crash and they're able to see everything that's happening. And if possible, it's always a good idea to have a crash trolley or a crash box ready in the practice. So I work in a large referral centre, and we're lucky enough to have a crash trolley, as you can see in this photo here, which is all laid out in the order in which we need things. So we've got ET tubes in the top drawer and then the drugs in the second drawer. But equally, you know, many smaller practices will have a crash box with just the essential drugs in there, and maybe a drug dosage chart, and that's absolutely fine, but it's a good idea to have some kind of a crash box ready to go. And if possible, it is good to have ET tubes and a laryngoscope in there as well, so that everything is to hand. And I like to have ET tubes that are ready with a tie on them, so that you don't have to mess about getting a tie and tying it in once you've intubated the patient. It's also very good idea to have located with your crash box a clipboard that's got printed record charts on it and a pen attached to it, and also to have a suction unit if possible, because if you've got a patient who's aspirated and arrested, you know, they might have a lot of fluid in the back of their throat that you need to suction out before you're able to intubate them, or RTAs and things like that that come in with blood in the back of the mouth and are arresting, then it's a good idea to have a suction unit to hand. In terms of actually initiating CPR, then obviously the first thing that we need to do is recognise when an animal has experienced a cardiopulmonary arrest. And The definition of cardiopulmonary arrest is actually a patient who is unresponsive and apneic. So, contrary to popular belief, it is not necessary to feel pulses to know whether or not the patient has arrested. And if they are, if they've lost consciousness and they're apneic, then that's an indication alone to start CPR. And the reason for that is because pulse palpation is very unreliable, notoriously so. And actually, in human medicine, only 2% of rescuers are able to accurately identify a lack of a pulse within 10 seconds. And that's the time frame that we want to have recognized and started CPR within. We don't want to wait any longer than 10 seconds, because every second of downtime where there's no heartbeat is time where the patient is more hypoxic and less likely to come back. So we want to start CPR as fast as possible. And also, in terms of people feeling for pulses, about a third of people will think that they can feel a pulse when there actually isn't one, and that's because they're feeling the pulse in their own finger. Obviously, if your patient is under anaesthesia when it arrests, then we would need to feel pulses, because clearly those patients are going to be unresponsive anyway, so apnea alone is not a sufficient indicator that the patient has arrested. So in a anaesthetic arrest situation, we would need to feel the pulses. If you recognise that a patient is in cardiopulmonary arrest, then the first thing to do is don't panic. And once you've kept your cool, then alert other people. So either sound the crash alarm if you're lucky enough to have a crash alarm system in your practice, but more likely just simply shout for help. And, you know, shouting crash is usually enough to make people realise what's going on and make them come running. Or some practices I know have a code word, so that it's perhaps a bit less obvious to clients what's happening. But some word to be shouted to alert other people that they need to drop what they're doing and come and help you. And in the meantime, if you're the person who has recognised that the patient has arrested, then start chest compressions while you're waiting for other people to turn up and help you. And then once other people arrive, they can start getting a tube in, getting the monitoring equipment on, and getting the drugs ready. We're going to talk about basic life support first and advanced life support afterwards. Basic life support is essentially good quality chest compressions and good quality ventilation. So these are, as we said before, the most important things that will make a real difference to the outcome of your patient. So these are the things that that we're going to focus on. The reason that we want to start chest compressions first before getting a tube into the patient is because, if you think about it, once the patient arrests, then once the heart stops, there's zero blood flow. And the blood doesn't desaturate from oxygen immediately. So there will still be some oxygen in the blood. But if the heart isn't beating, that oxygen isn't going anywhere. It's not getting to the respiring tissues. So we need to maintain some blood flow in order to deliver the remaining oxygen in the blood to the tissues that need it, and most importantly, in a crash situation, to the heart and the brain. So we've got a few seconds before we need to get a tube in and start breathing for the patient. That's not to say that we want to delay intubating the patient. It's just that if there's only one person there initially, it's more important to start chest compressions than it is to intubate the patient. And then as soon as there's somebody else available, we want to get a tube in and start IPPV. But really, we don't want to stop chest compressions in order to enable intubation. So it's important that the person who's intubating the patient is confident doing that in lateral recumbency and with a moving target as well. Because when we're doing chest compressions, the patient will be moving around a bit. But the reason that we don't want to stop chest compressions is because it takes 60 seconds of continuous chest compressions to get the cardiac output up to the maximum that we can achieve. And unfortunately, the maximum cardiac output that we can achieve by chest compressions is only about 30% compared with what the cardiac output would be if the heart were beating by itself. So we really need to maximize our cardiac output as much as possible. And every time we interrupt chest compressions, our cardiac output falls back to zero, and then it's going to take another 60 seconds to build it back up to the maximum amount that we can. So it's important that people do try and intubate whilst chest compressions are occurring. And if one person's struggling, it's better to get somebody else to do it rather than to stop chest compressions. And in terms of the chest compressions, then we want to go for uninterrupted cycles of 2 minutes. And the reason that we go for 2 minutes is because, as I just said, it's going to take 60 seconds to get the maximum cardiac output that we can achieve. But after a further 60 seconds, people start to fatigue, and they usually don't feel like they're fatiguing because everybody has a big adrenaline surge during CPR and they feel like they can keep going. But actually, people do start to fatigue, and this is quite a physical thing to do. And what happens is that they start to lean on the animal's chest. So when we're compressing the chest, what we want to do is aim for a compression of between a third and half of the width of the chest in order to drive blood forwards around the system. But then we need to allow a complete elastic recoil of the rib cage, because as the chest re-expands after a compression, then the negative pressure that that generates in the chest as the rib cage re-expands draws blood back into the thorax from the abdomen to refill the heart, ready for the next compression. And so the recoil phase is just as important as the compressive phase. Although people don't really have that in their mind as they're doing chest compressions, people tend to think compress, compress, compress. They're not thinking about the importance of the recoil bit. And as people start to tire, then by leaning on the chest, they're not allowing that complete elastic recoil. And that means that they're not getting enough filling of the heart ready for the next beat, and therefore the cardiac output declines. The rate at which we want to do CPR is between 100 and 120 beats per minute. And some people have a natural tendency to go a bit slower than that. Some people have a natural tendency to go a bit faster than that. So it's good to have a mental guide. And the classic song that is 100 beats per minute is Nelly the Elephant, which I commonly sing at people as they're doing CPR to make sure that they're going at the right rate. So here is an excerpt of Nelly the Elephant for those of you not so familiar with it.
Trunk and said goodbye to the circus. Off she went with a trumpety trump, 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 trump.
So there you have it. That one was Nelly the Elephant. And for those of you not so familiar or happy with British nursery rhymes, then my personal other favourite song, which is 100 beats per minute, is this one. But the American Heart Association actually has a CPR playlist on Spotify with many 100 beats per minute songs on there, including Staying Alive and many others. So do feel free to check that out. That's freely available. And you can pick your favourite 100 beats per minute song to do CPR to. When we're doing chest compressions, in almost all situations, with one exception, which we'll talk about in a bit, we will have the patient in lateral recumbency. And the position that we take to do chest compressions is really key to the effectiveness of our CPR efforts. And this is probably the area where I see people struggling the most to execute the right technique. So what we want to do during chest compressions is to have our arms straight with our elbows locked, and our shoulders directly above our wrists, as you can see demonstrated in the photograph on this slide. And the reason that we want to have this arm position is because as we compress the chest by having our elbows locked and our shoulders above our wrists, it transmits the force directly down through the arms and through the chest. So the whole force that we're generating is going through the heel of your hand. You want to have your two hands interlocked as well, as you can see in that photo, to make sure that the force is transmitted through the smallest area possible, which is the heel of one hand. If you're transmitting the force over a wider area, then some of the force generated will be dissipated. And you also want to bend from the waist. So you're really using your core muscles to do this. You're bending from the waist so that all the force is going down through your shoulders. If you find that you're bending your arms as you're doing CPR, then all that you're doing is you're probably giving yourself a pretty good workout, but you won't actually be generating a lot of force through the chest and you won't be generating a lot of cardiac output for that patient. So make sure that you keep your elbows locked at all times. If you're short, I'm particularly short, I personally get on the table to do CPR because otherwise I find that I have to bend my arms in order to do chest compressions. So it's better for me to kneel behind the patient. If you have a hydraulic table, then you could raise it or lower it to suit your height, and that works just as well. Or maybe if you had a very big dog, it might be more practical to put it on the floor and do chest compressions on the floor. But however you do it, you want to ensure that you are above the patient such that you can keep your arms straight at all times. And if you don't remember anything else about chest compressions, then I think that the human CPR strap line of push hard, push fast is pretty good. So if you don't remember anything else, then just remember to push hard and push fast. This is a video that we have here of one of our nurses performing CPR with correct technique and the correct rate. So here we go. And as you can see, she's got her arms nice and straight. She's got her shoulders above her wrists and she's bending from the waist and she's going at the correct rate. By comparison, this is a real life video of the same nurse doing CPR. Now, there are a couple of things which are not perfect about this, including the position of her relative to the dog. Ideally, she should be standing behind the dog with the spine against her, and we'll speak about that in a moment, but unfortunately the situation in which this dog crashed didn't allow that to happen. Also, she doesn't have her hands locked, but apart from that her technique is quite good, except that she's going a lot faster here, as you can see. And this is a good demonstration that in a mock-up situation like we saw in the previous video, it's a lot easier to go at the right rate. But in a real-life situation, when everybody's feeling the adrenaline surge, it's easy to go a little too fast. So that's why it's good to either sing the song in your head or even have somebody playing a song so that you can maintain the correct rate. So as I just said, you really want to be standing behind the animal when you're doing chest compressions with the spine against you. And that's because of the shape of most animals' chests. In most animals' cases, they're going to have a vaguely teardrop-shaped chest. So you can imagine if you're standing on the sternal side of the animal doing chest compressions, because of the shape of their chest and the angle of their rib cage, you're going to find that you're pushing the animal away from you, and you sort of end up chasing it across the table if you're doing that. Whereas if you stand with the spine against you, like you can see in this photo, then as you compress the chest, you're pushing the animal into you, and therefore you're stabilizing it with your own body. And that just obviously makes the compressions more effective. But there are different mechanisms for how we will compress the chest, and that largely depends on the size of the animal and the shape of the chest. So for animals that are under 10 kilos, so this is going to be cats, small furries, and little dogs, then we're going to directly compress over the heart in the ventral third of the thorax. This method of compression is called the cardiac pump theory because we're directly squeezing the heart as we do it. So for cats and small furries, which generally have a very soft and compliant rib cage, then probably the easiest way to do this is using a single hand technique where you wrap one hand around the animal's sternum, like you can see in this cartoon from the Recover Guidelines. So you end up with four fingers on one side of the rib cage and your thumb on the other side. And as you squeeze the chest, you're directly compressing the heart between your fingers. And certainly in cats, because they do have a very compliant thorax, you can actually often feel the heart in between your hands, in between your fingers. It's a good idea with this technique to use your other hand to stabilize the spine. So again, you're not pushing the animal across the table, you're just holding it nice and steady as you do it. For dogs which tend to have a slightly stiffer rib cage, or for larger cats, then it may be more practical to use the two-handed technique where you interlock your hands like we've seen on those videos, but you're compressing directly over the heart in the ventral third of the thorax. We also use this technique for sight hounds, so the keel-chested dogs. Again, because of the shape of their thorax, we're able to directly compress the heart in those dogs. I tend to also resort to this if I'm getting tired when I'm compressing a cat with a single-handed technique, because as you do that squeezing motion with your hand, you find quite quickly that you use muscles that you never use in ordinary life, and you tend to find that you get a cramp in your thumb and your forearm quite quickly. So if you're getting very tired doing that, then you can resort to this two-handed technique in cats as well. For larger dogs, so basically any dog that's over 10 kilos and is not a sight hound, then we're going to compress over the widest part of the thorax. And that's because these dogs have a slightly more, not an actual barrel-chested conformation, but it's a slightly rounder conformation to the chest. And so you can imagine if you were compressing directly over where the heart is, the angle of the rib cage is too steep to be able to effectively compress at that location. So what we're doing here is compressing the thorax in such a way that we are causing a generalized increase in intrathoracic pressure. So we're not squeezing the heart directly, but by increasing the pressure in the chest, that drives blood forwards through the heart. So the overall effect ends up being the same, but we're just compressing in a different place on the chest. And the Recover Guidelines from 2012 do talk about barrel-chested exceptions. So these are basically the bulldogs and the Boston Terriers and all the little brachycephalics that we see so many of nowadays, where their chest is as wide as it is deep, or in some instances even a bit wider than it is deep. And these dogs, if you think about it, their chest conformation is a little more similar to a human chest conformation, being wider than we are deep. And so for these dogs, you can consider doing sternal compressions. And the evidence for this is very poor, but this is something to consider doing. So it may be, if you've tried lateral compressions and you're not getting anywhere, then you want to try this as an alternative, or you may just opt to go for this in the first place. So it really depends on the conformation of the patient as to which technique you're going to use for compressing the chest. So just eyeball your patient at the start of CPR and make a decision. When you're intubating a patient during CPR, then it's very important that you don't let go of the tube until it's secured in place, because as chest compressions are occurring, then it's very easy for the tube to move and become dislodged. And if you take your hand off the tube before it's tied in, you can find that it's come out altogether, or it's even come out and gone into the esophagus. So keep hold of the tube until it's secured in place. And a technique that that I like for securing it in place in the short term before you've got a tube tie is using some micropore, as you can see in this photograph down the bottom here. So that's very easy to just micropore the tube to the muzzle, and you can either do it to the upper or the lower jaw, whichever seems easier at the time, just to temporarily hold it in place whilst you get a tube tie to tie it in more securely. And remember to inflate the cuff, because obviously you won't be able to perform effective IPPV if you've got a leak around the outside of the tube. So even in cats, we want to be using a cuff tube and making sure that we're inflating the cuff to get a seal. And we want to be delivering breaths at a rate of 10 breaths per minute, so that's one every 6 seconds. And ideally, we would like to aim for a tidal volume of 10 mils per kilo. Now, if you have a spirometer, then you can use that to make sure that you're delivering the right tidal volume, but obviously most people don't have spirometry readily available in their practice. So that's fine, don't worry about that. It's just a good idea to make sure that the breath that you're delivering gives normal chest excursion. So we don't want the animal's chest to be moving excessively. We don't want it to be taking tiny breaths either. So just sort of eyeball what's going on and make sure that you're getting a normal chest excursion. One of the other things that I commonly see people doing incorrectly during CPR is the rate at which they give the breath. Because much like the chest compressions, where everybody's just thinking about the compression and they're thinking, I must compress, I must compress, I must compress, people do the same with the breaths, and they're thinking, breathe for it, breathe for it, breathe for it. And what tends to happen is that people give the inspiration quite aggressively and quickly. And that can be damaging to the lungs, particularly because somebody else is jumping up and down on the chest doing chest compressions at the same time. So what we want to do is achieve an inspiration over the course of a second. So a nice gentle squeeze of the bag, nice and slowly over a second, and then allow 5 seconds for expiration. And the expiration will occur passively and will be aided by the chest compressions. Remember that if you're doing IPPV, then you want to be using either a T-piece or a Bane to be doing that. Or if you have an ambu bag, then that's fine as well. I actually prefer ambu bags for CPR because you don't need to fiddle about with the valve opening and closing it. All you need to do is squeeze the bag. Ambu bags can connect to your oxygen outlet, so you can provide 100% oxygen through an ambu bag, but equally you can ventilate with room air using an ambu bag. So if a patient crashes miles away from an anaesthetic point, then that's a good way by which you can still perform IPPV. And in most instances, if the patient was breathing room air before they arrested, then they can breathe room air during an arrest as well if you don't have oxygen nearby. If they're arresting because of lung disease, yes, it absolutely would be better to ventilate them with 100% oxygen. But in some instances, that's just not practical. And if you have an ambu bag, that will enable you to get around that problem. So that's the essentials, the basic life support. And then everything else on top of that counts as advanced life support, which is what we'll just talk about for the second half of the lecture. And advanced life support is everything else, and that's the drugs, defibrillation if we're going to do it, any fluid therapy, and any other treatments that we might be doing for the patient during the CPR. In terms of the drugs, in most situations, we're going to aim to give both adrenaline and atropine. And as a general rule of thumb, that won't do you wrong if you remember to give both adrenaline and atropine in most instances. And the two drugs work synergistically, but in different ways. So the mechanism of adrenaline is via vasoconstriction, and by causing peripheral massive vasoconstriction, adrenaline redirects blood to the organs that need it the most at that point in time, which is essentially the brain and the heart, the main organs that need blood supply during a crash event. Adrenaline also has inotropic and chronotropic effects. And on the face of it, you might think that that's a good thing, but actually that's detrimental in a CPR situation because the myocardium is already deprived of oxygen in an arrest situation. And so by increasing the force and the rate of the cardiac contractility, then that also increases its oxygen demand. And therefore that can be detrimental and it can lead to dysrhythmias as a result and worsening myocardial ischemia. But unfortunately, that's one of those side effects that we just need to be aware of and just accept it because there isn't really a way around it. The benefits of adrenaline are greater than the negatives, but we just need to be aware that there are some downsides to it. And what we want to do is aim to give adrenaline every 3 to 5 minutes until we get the patient back. Or an easier way to remember it is to give it during every other cycle of people doing chest compressions. So every other person doing the chest compressions, give another dose of adrenaline. Adrenaline doesn't work very well in an acidic environment. And so as time goes on and the patient remains arrested, then the buildup of lactic acid is increasing and therefore the patient's pH is dropping as time goes on. So after 10 minutes of CPR, then we should remember to increase the dose of adrenaline 10 times because that will help to slightly overcome the fact that it doesn't work very well in an acidic environment. It loses its affinity for the receptors. But if we give a higher dose, then that will go some way to overcoming that effect, and adrenaline should still have some activity in a more acidic environment. Atropine is a parasympatholytic and so causes tachycardia by blocking the action of acetylcholine. And this is going to be most useful when an arrest is vagally mediated. So for example, patients who pass diarrhea and then arrest, or they vomit and then they arrest, or they urinate and then they arrest, or patients who are arresting because of an upper respiratory tract obstruction. These are all vagally mediated arrest situations. And in this situation, atropine is probably the most important drug to get on board first. And again, like adrenaline, we want to give this every 3 to 5 minutes until we get the patient back. The evidence for giving atropine every 3 to 5 minutes is not as strong as for giving adrenaline every 3 to 5 minutes. And the half-life of atropine is about 40 minutes. So it may be that we actually only need to give it once at the start of CPR and then it's on board for the remainder of the time that we're going to be performing CPR. But the recover guidelines say that we should consider giving it every 3 to 5 minutes. And so for ease of remembering what to do, I normally recommend giving both adrenaline and atropine every 3 to 5 minutes or every other cycle of chest compressions. Be aware that atropine is not always useful in rabbits because 40% of rabbits have atropine esterase, which breaks it down and therefore it won't be effective. And so ideally, if you're doing CPR in rabbits, it's better to use glycopyrrolate instead of atropine. So if you have that available in your practice, then that's the preferred drug in rabbits. For many patients that arrest in the hospital, they will already have an IV in which case we should use that. And certainly IV is the preferred route to give any drugs during CPR. So if you have an IV available, use it. If you don't have an IV, so a patient comes in arresting or arrests immediately after being admitted into the hospital and doesn't yet have an IV, then it can be very difficult to place a peripheral IV, because as soon as the circulation stops, the veins collapse, and it can be impossible to percutaneously place an IV. So it's often better in that situation to do a cut down, as you can see in these photos here, where you basically just make a skin incision. It's not particularly pretty. Remember not to do it directly over the vein, because you might cut through the vein, but just do it to one side and then pull your skin incision across to where the vein is, and blunt dissect down to the vein to isolate it and put the catheter directly in. You can either suture or glue it in place, although both have their disadvantages. I find that gluing doesn't work very well and suturing is quite time consuming, so neither is ideal, but find some way to secure it in the short term. And remember, if you do get the patient back, as obviously hopefully you will, then replace this IV as soon as it's possible to get a more sterile IV in, then you want to get this one out. This photograph at the top, I think we've got a close-up, here it is. You can see this is a sort of a 10 kilo little fluffy dog, and this is a jugular cut down, and yet I've only been able to get a yellow IV catheter into this. So this gives you an idea of just how collapsed the veins become as soon as the circulation stops. So you can see it's often going to be very unrewarding to place a peripheral IV, and you can just about see a peripheral vein in the bottom picture there. It's absolutely minuscule. So don't waste too much time trying to get a percutaneous IV peripherally if you don't already have pre-existing IV access. If you're giving drugs IV, then remember to flush it with a big flush volume. So for dogs, I'm normally going to be flushing with 10 to 20 mils. For cats, more like 5 to 10 mils, depending on the size of the cat. But basically, you want to flush it with enough volume that the drug is going to get back into the central circulation. If you inject a small volume of adrenaline or atropine into the leg and then you flush it with only 2 mils, the adrenaline is going to be sitting slightly higher up in the leg than where you injected it. So you need to make sure that you flush it with enough flush to get it all the way back to the heart. And drawing up large flush volumes is quite time consuming, so it's a good idea if possible to have some pre-drawn flushes in your practice that you can use in this situation. So we keep a number of 20 ml syringes with flush volume drawn up, and then the nurses change those on a daily basis. If you don't have any IV access available, then you can try an intraosseous catheter instead. This is easier in neonates and pediatrics because they have softer bones. And the IO route is equally effective as the IV route because the bone marrow is confluent with the circulation. So if you inject drugs intraosseously, then they end up in the central circulation just as quickly as if you've given them IV. And to do this, you can place a catheter or a hypodermic needle, either into the tibia or into the femur. You can use the humerus as well, although I tend to find that it gets dislodged quite easily because of the shoulder blade. But if you're going into the tibia, then you would go through the tibial crest perpendicular to the leg and just use a gentle corkscrew action to advance the needle, and then you will feel the loss of resistance as soon as it goes into the medullary cavity and then stop advancing. If you're in the right place, it should flush with no resistance. And if you're going for the femur, then you would just go into the trochanteric fossa and aim directly down the shaft of the femur towards the stifle. If it becomes dislodged, as often these do, they are very difficult to secure in place, then just remember if you're replacing it, you need to replace it into a different bone, because otherwise once you've made a hole in the bone and then you replace the catheter into the same bone, the fluid will just come out of the bone and you get a fat leg. If you don't have either IV or IO access available, then you can give most drugs that we're going to be giving during CPR down the trachea. You can give all of the drugs except for bicarbonate and calcium down the ET tube. You need to remember to double the drug dosage if you're going to do that. And the way to do it is to use a stiff dog urinary catheter. I keep one of these in the crash trolley, so it's easily accessible during CPR. And you can see this setup in the photo on this slide. But basically, you pass the catheter down the ET tube and then inject the double drug dosage down the catheter, diluted up to about 5 mils in saline to make sure that it goes through, and then flush it with more saline as well to make sure that the drugs are not just sitting in the urinary catheter, so they've actually gone into the lungs. You pass the catheter basically as far as it will go down the ET tube until it stops. Once you've injected the drugs, then it will disperse with only a couple of breaths, and actually the absorption from the lungs is extremely good because it has such a good blood supply. So after a couple of breaths, the drugs will be absorbed into the circulation. So this is a very reasonable alternative if you don't have IV access, but IV is always a preferable route. This is a question that I get asked quite commonly. Should we give drugs direct into the heart? And the answer is no. By directly injecting into the myocardium, we can actually cause areas of myocardial infarction where we put the needle in. And the myocardium is already challenged and compromised in this situation and is starved of oxygen. So it's much more likely that we will cause further damage to the heart by injecting into it. That can certainly result in worsening dysrhythmias. And these patients are highly prone to rearrest once they've received an intracardiac injection. I have personally never seen a patient survive long term who's received an intracardiac injection. They've all gone on to rearrest afterwards. And this is another question which I'm commonly asked as well, which is, should we give fluids during CPR? And the answer to that is that we should only give fluids if the patient is arresting because they are hypovolemic. So if they're arresting because they've got HGE and they've just passed a huge volume of bloody diarrhea, then yes, they absolutely need fluids. If they're arresting because they've got a GDV or they've got a hemoabdomen or really severe vomiting diarrhea, then all of those patients will require a fluid bolus during CPR. But if they are normovolemic, so maybe they're arresting under GA and their volume status is normal, then it's actually detrimental to give fluids. And the reason for that, you can see from this equation I've got on the slide here. So the perfusion pressure of the heart is determined by the pressure in the aorta minus the pressure in the right atrium. Now, you can imagine as we give fluids, we're giving that into the venous system. And so the first place in the heart that the fluid is going to is the right atrium. And therefore, you can see straight away from this equation that by giving a fluid bolus, we will be increasing the right atrial pressure, and therefore we will be decreasing the perfusion pressure of the heart itself. And that is associated with a worse outcome for the patients. So if they're hypovolemic, absolutely they require a fluid bolus. But if they're normovolemic, then it will be associated with a worse outcome to give those patients fluids. If the patient arrests under anaesthesia, then Firstly, we want to turn off the gaseous agent straight away and make sure that they're on 100% oxygen. So either flush the circuit, or I actually prefer to just change the circuit, because as we all know, if you flush the circuit, it still stinks of ISO. So I prefer to just grab a fresh circuit and pop that on. And you want to remember to reverse any potentially reversible drugs. So the drugs which can be reversed are alpha-2 agonists, which are reversed with atipamezole, opioids, which are reversed with naloxone, and benzodiazepines, which are reversed with flumazenil. And it's a good idea to keep all of those in your crash box. And I will reverse any drugs which the patient has received that day. So even if the patient was pre-medded at 9 o'clock in the morning and it's now 3 o'clock in the afternoon and you're thinking, well, there's no way that these drugs are still on board, I will still reverse them, because it's very unlikely that it's going to do any harm by reversing them. And at that moment in time, we probably don't really know why the patient is arresting, and maybe they've got some abnormal metabolism, and maybe these drugs have accumulated. We just don't know at that point. So it's a good idea to just always reverse the drugs. If you do have a patient that's under GA and you're operating on the abdomen, you've already got the abdomen open, then it's a good idea to just go through the diaphragm and do open chest CPR and directly compress the heart. Because, well, for one, open chest CPR is associated with better outcomes than closed chest CPR, because by directly squeezing the heart, you get a much better cardiac output than doing closed chest CPR. And also, if you've got the abdomen open, it would be impractical to then close the abdomen, turn the patient into lateral recumbency, and then start CPR. You're just going to lose way too much time doing that, and you'll never get the patient back after that much downtime. So you should just go through the diaphragm, start compressing the heart directly. But in other situations, it's really not advisable to attempt any form of open chest CPR unless you're in a very big hospital that does have resources available to look after those patients post-arrest. Because if you get them back after open chest CPR via a lateral thoracotomy, like you can see in these photos here, then these patients need to be anaesthetized immediately. They need to have a full exploratory thoracotomy, clean everything out, close them up again. That's really major care that these patients need. So don't attempt open chest CPR unless you have the facilities to provide that level of care afterwards, which is mostly going to be in a referral setting. And once you've got all of your basic CPR underway, then you can start to think about what's the underlying cause. So once you're happy that you've got your chest compressions and your ventilation and you're giving your drugs every 3 to 5 minutes, then you can start to think, okay, why has this animal arrested? And you'll find that there's a little bit of downtime then once everything's underway. And you can start to think about, well, does the animal have a pneumothorax? Does it have a pleural effusion? Do we need to be draining that? Is it hypovolemic and it needs fluids? Maybe it's pulmonary edema because it's in heart failure and it needs some furosemide. And then anything that can be treated while CPR is happening should be done. So you can do thoracocentesis, for example, as chest compressions are occurring. So now we're going to talk about how to monitor our CPR and gauge our success during the CPR efforts. And the two main monitoring things that we're going to be doing with these patients are ECG and capnography. And with an ECG, we're going to be looking for one of really four arrest rhythms. Two of these arrest rhythms are extremely rare. Most of you will never see this. But we'll talk about the four more common arrest rhythms that we might identify. And to assess the ECG, you can only interpret the ECG when chest compressions are not occurring, because as somebody's jumping up and down on the chest, the legs are moving all over the place and you get a meaningless squiggle on the ECG trace. So you don't want to stop the cycles of 2 minutes of chest compressions to interpret the ECG like we were saying before. So a good idea is to look at the ECG for a couple of seconds whilst you're changing over the person who's doing the chest compressions. But you don't want to have an interruption of any longer than 10 seconds between chest compressions, but you don't need that long. You only really need 2 or 3 seconds, just a glance at the ECG, determine the rhythm, and then keep going with chest compressions. One of the two most common arrest rhythms is going to be a systole, so a flat line, everyone can recognise that. And about a third of dogs and half of cats will arrest in a systole. And the treatment for that is good quality basic life support, so good quality chest compressions and ventilation, and then adrenaline and atropine every 3 to 5 minutes. Pulseless electrical activity is the other most common arrest rhythm that we'll see, and again, similar percentages of dogs and cats will arrest in this rhythm compared with asystole. This is the one that can be a little more difficult to identify because it can look like a sinus rhythm on the ECG, but this is obviously just what it says on the tin, where we've got an electrical trace but we've got no cardiac motion, no contractility, and therefore no pulses generated. Unfortunately, this is one of the most difficult rhythms to treat. It can be very difficult to convert these patients into sinus rhythm, but the treatment is the same as for asystole, so good quality chest compressions and ventilation and adrenaline and atropine every 3 to 5 minutes. Sinus bradycardia is reported as an uncommon arrest rhythm, about 6% of dogs arresting in sinus bradycardia. Personally, I think that probably the incidence is actually a lot higher than that, because most patients brady down before they actually arrest. It's just that in most instances we don't recognise the bradycardic phase, and by the time we recognise it they're already in asystole. But if they have a very slow heart rate and they're unresponsive and apneic, then it means that they're, even though the heart is still beating, the total cardiac output that they're generating is not high enough to maintain consciousness. They're not getting enough oxygen, and that's still a definition of arrest. So if you have a bradycardic patient that's unresponsive and apneic, then that's an indication to start CPR. That's still a form of arrest. And again, the treatment for this is good quality chest compressions and ventilation and adrenaline and atropine every 3 to 5 minutes. Ventricular fibrillation is the one that is treated a bit differently from the other three rhythms. Here's a trace of it down the bottom. It's completely uncoordinated activity of the ventricles, because basically every individual myocardial cell is trying to be the pacemaker, is trying to generate a contractile impulse, and what happens is that the heart literally is sort of writhing around, like it looks like a can of worms if you see it fibrillating. This is relatively uncommon, about 15% of dogs will arrest in VF, but it may happen at some point during CPR in up to a third of dogs. And we see this less commonly in cats, about just over 10% of cats will experience ventricular fibrillation during CPR at some point. The treatment for ventricular fibrillation is defibrillation, so the clue is in the name. You only need to defibrillate something if it is fibrillating. And coupled with that, then we give adrenaline on every other cycle of compressions, so every 3 to 5 minutes. If you have an electrical defibrillator in your practice, then this would be an indication to use it. And by electrically defibrillating the patient, we're going to deliver an electric shock across the heart, which the aim is to stop that random electrical activity. So you kind of stun the heart into stopping what it's doing. And the idea of stunning it like that is that that enables enough time for the sinoatrial node to discharge and recapture control of the heart to restart coordinated contractile activity. If you're doing it, then you want to clip the fur first. If you don't clip the fur, you won't get good contact with the skin and all you'll do is singe the fur. And then you want to have the paddles on either side of the sternum, like you can see in the photo there. And you want to discharge the paddles across the heart. It's really important that we haven't spirited the patient before doing this because the animal will catch fire if they've been spirited. So don't use spirit during CPR if there's any chance that you might electrically defibrillate them. It's important that if you're the person operating the defibrillator that you do it safely, and it's your responsibility to make sure that nobody is in contact with either the patient or the table before you discharge the defibrillator. That includes making sure that you're not in contact with the patient or the table either. And then shout clear before you discharge it, and after you've said clear, visually check again that nobody is touching the patient or the table, including yourself. And beware of the animal's legs flopping around. Just make sure that they don't touch your arms or any other part of your body as you discharge the defibrillator so that you don't shock yourself. If you've defibrillated a patient, then you want to immediately resume chest compressions and keep going for another 2 minutes before you check the ECG. The reason for that is because almost three quarters of patients who convert from ventricular fibrillation into a sinus rhythm will slip back into VF within the first 60 seconds. So if you get an immediate conversion to sinus rhythm, that's, or asystole, that's not indicative of sustained success of your defibrillation efforts. So it's better to compress for another 2 minutes so that you know the patient's still got some circulation happening, and then give another shock 2 minutes later if you need to and the patient is still in fibrillation at that point. We don't really have any good evidence for how much we should increase the energy of the defibrillator by, but generally speaking, we would increase it by 50% each time we deliver a shock up to the maximum amount that the defibrillator can deliver, which is normally about 300 joules. Historically, people would give three stacked shocks where you just literally shock the patient three times in a row. But we know now that that is associated with a worse outcome overall because the time that it takes to recharge the defibrillator and discharge it in between each shock amounts to a detrimental amount of time when chest compressions are not happening and therefore there's no blood flow. So we don't do that anymore. Just do one shock every 2 minutes with chest compressions in between. If you don't have an electrical defibrillator, then you can attempt mechanical defibrillation instead, which aims to do basically the same thing, where we're going to stun the heart into stopping its random electrical activity and enable the sinoatrial node to recapture the heart. And we can do that by a precordial thump, which is where you basically hit the patient pretty hard on the lateral chest. You're going to do it just behind where the elbow touches the chest, just over the heart. And the way to do it is to make a fist with your hand and keep your wrist straight as though you're sort of playing tennis, and then thump the patient with the back of your hand and forearm just on the side of the chest. It's not as effective as electrical defibrillation, but it's a reasonable thing to do if you don't have an electrical defibrillator and your patient is fibrillating. And I have used this technique successfully in the past. So this is a reasonable thing to try. A successful defibrillation is anything that converts the patient out of ventricular fibrillation. So it may be that you convert the patient into a sinus rhythm. Brilliant, well done, you can stop CPR, you've got the patient back. But it may be that you convert them into asystole, and that's fine as well. You've still successfully stopped the fibrillation, but then you need to continue CPR with your basic life support, chest compressions and ventilation, and continue giving your atropine and adrenaline every 3 to 5 minutes until such time as you get the patient back or you discontinue CPR. Aside from an ECG, the other most useful thing that we're going to use in terms of monitoring is a capnograph. And the reason that capnography is so useful during CPR is because it's a good indicator of cardiac output. And if you think about it, the patient's tissues are respiring and producing carbon dioxide as a byproduct. And the carbon dioxide is delivered to the lungs via the heart. So the amount of carbon dioxide that's breathed out is an indirect indicator of the cardiac output. And therefore, it's an indicator of how effective our CPR is. And we know that if our end-tidal CO2 is above 15, then there is a better chance that we're going to get a return of spontaneous circulation compared with if the end-tidal CO2 is less than 15. And it may be that if the end-tidal CO2 is low, then you might want to adjust the position on the chest at which you're compressing, because sometimes you find that there's kind of like a sweet spot on the chest where you get the best cardiac output, and it might be that you're not quite compressing in the right place. It may be that the person doing chest compressions is tired and fatiguing, and that might be an indication to change the person doing compressions. If someone's compressing and they're only getting an end-tidal CO2 of zero, whereas the person that's compressing before was getting an end-tidal CO2 of 18, then you know you might want to switch that person out. And we can also use capnography to give us a first idea of when we have got a return of spontaneous circulation, because like we said before, when we're doing chest compressions, we can only achieve a maximum of about 30% cardiac output compared with when the heart is beating for itself. So if the heart starts beating again, we get a massive surge in CO2 delivered back to the lungs. And we often see that the capnograph will jump from 15, 16, 17 up to 75 or 80. And if you see that happen, that's an indication to hold chest compressions and feel for pulses, because the likelihood is that the patient's heart is beating again for itself. I'm not too bothered about feeling pulses during CPR. People often do this as a means of trying to determine whether the chest compressions are effective or not, and are generating pulses. But you have to be careful with the interpretation of it, because you can get what's called retrograde venous flow, which is where you get like a recoil of blood back through the venous system, and it can feel like a pulse. So sometimes you might be thinking that you can feel a pulse, but actually you're just feeling this retrograde venous flow, which is not indicative of cardiac output. So if there's loads of people during a CPR and there's people that don't have jobs to do, by all means somebody can feel a pulse, but I don't hold too much weight on the pulse palpation. If you do have blood gas available in your practice, then that can be useful during CPR to look at your electrolytes and also to look at the effectiveness of your ventilation and see if there's anything that needs specific treatment during the CPR. Be aware that you will want to get a venous sample, not an arterial sample, during CPR, because that's more reflective of what's going on for the patient during cardiopulmonary arrest. I often get asked about taking blood pressure during CPR, and blood pressure is really not useful whilst CPR efforts are occurring. aside from anything else, you will not be able to measure a blood pressure during CPR because the cardiac output is just not adequate to get a registrable blood pressure. And also, it's not really going to tell you anything very useful because you're deliberately giving drugs to cause vasoconstriction of the periphery. And so a peripheral blood pressure is not really very reflective of what's going on at the organ level, which is what you really want to know. But as soon as you get the patient back, then you absolutely want to get a blood pressure as soon as possible, because patients often lose vascular tone after CPR and they are commonly hypotensive and require blood pressure support. So as soon as the heart starts beating again for itself, you want to get a blood pressure reading, but not until that point. It won't tell you anything useful. And similarly with pulse oximetry, that's not going to tell you anything useful during CPR either. You know, it really doesn't matter what the oxygen content of the peripheral capillaries is during CPR. You only really care what's going on at the brain and the heart level. And also with pulse ox, you know, the clue is in the name. You need a pulse to be able to generate a meaningful number. So during CPR, you know, you don't have an adequate pulse to give you a meaningful reading anyway. So any number that you do get is likely to be a randomly generated number. Do try and contact the owner as soon as possible. It doesn't have to be the case clinician, and often the person whose case it is might be involved in running the CPR. So it could be anybody else that you send to call the owner. It could be another vet, it could be a nurse, but somebody needs to call the owner to just let them know what's happening and find out if they want to continue or not. If a patient arrests unexpectedly and a code status has not been discussed with the owners, then I think it's appropriate to always start CPR in that situation, but then contact the owner as soon as possible to discuss whether they do or they don't want to continue. If you know that the owners have requested resuscitation in the event of an arrest and there's nobody free to call the owner, then that might be a situation where you wait a bit longer before contacting them to let them know what's happening, because they've already said that they want you to do it, so everybody's focusing on just doing the CPR. But I think it's always good to try and contact owners at the earliest opportunity so that they're fully informed of what's happening. The end point that we're aiming for is ROSC, which is a return of spontaneous circulation. And actually, we will achieve that in about 35 to 45% of cases in which we're performing CPR. However, many patients will re-arrest within seconds to minutes of their initial ROSC event. And ultimately, the outcomes are not so favourable. We'll talk about that on the final slide. But if we do get the patient back, then we need to think about supporting them through the post-arrest period. And often getting them back can be the easy bit, and getting them through the next few days can be the harder bit, because all of the organs are damaged by a period of blood stasis and hypoxia. And we will often see dysfunction of the kidneys, the liver, the brain, certainly in all cases. Animals will always be blind immediately after an arrest, and I never let owners euthanize that animal because it's blind, because in many instances that will come back over the following days or so, but initially all animals will be blind because the visual pathway is so delicate and prone to hypoxic damage. Also, animals will not breathe for themselves immediately after their heart starts beating again, so you will need to continue to provide IPPV, often for several hours before they start to breathe again. So again, that's a normal part of the sort of the brain dysfunction afterwards, and don't think that their prognosis is worse because they're not breathing for themselves straight away. We often see other organs damaged as well, so they often get very horrendous GI upsets. They can get coagulopathies. So they can even get lung dysfunction and dysrhythmias. So any organ basically can be affected during the post-arrest period. And it's important to provide supportive care for these guys with oxygen to maximise the oxygen that we're getting to the brain and the heart and all their other organs. We ideally want to have the patients elevated between 15 and 30 degrees. And by that, I don't just mean elevating the head, but the whole patient. Because if you just elevate the head, what you tend to do is cause a crick in the neck, and that will interfere with venous drainage from the brain, and it can raise the intracranial pressure. The reason for elevating them between 15 to 30 degrees is to maximize venous drainage from the brain without compromising arterial supply, and therefore minimizing the risk of brain swelling post CPR. I like to give antioxidants. I like N-acetylcysteine, which is an injectable antioxidant, as a form of free radical scavenger to prevent or to minimize the ischemia reperfusion injury, which happens following a CPR event. The evidence for that is relatively poor, but the theoretical benefit is quite great, and it's a fairly benign thing to do, so I like to do that. I don't let people take jugular sticks from post-arrest patients because, again, if you're occluding the jugular, you're going to raise the intracranial pressure, which can make their neurologic status worse. So it's good to use a peripheral vein instead for any sticks that you want to do. And I also don't actively warm these patients because hypothermia is protective following an arrest. And there's quite a lot of research in people to do with active hypothermia post-arrest, where they cool people down very dramatically and then ventilate them. And, you know, that's not really practical in our patients. But in most instances, our patients will be cold after an arrest because they're small, they've lost body heat during the arrest, they're not moving. So I like to just put blankets over them. I don't let them get any colder than they already are, but I don't actively warm them because by keeping them a bit colder, it keeps their metabolic rate down, and that's beneficial in terms of the ischemia reperfusion injury and the free radical damage that occurs. Let them warm up by themselves. As they start to move around, their body temperature will slowly increase, and the aim is for them to get back to normal temperature within about 24 hours. Most of them actually will warm up a bit quicker than that as they start to move around. But I really don't worry about it if they remain cold for a good 24 hours or so after the arrest. So overall, the outcome of CPR is about 50% of patients who arrest under GA will survive to discharge. And these are really the patients that we should be getting back. You know, these are the ones where we want to have a really effective team and be really good at CPR to maximise our chances of working well as a team to get these patients back, because these are the ones that are arresting not because of something wrong with them, but because of something we've done to them. We've given them drugs that have caused them to arrest. So these are the ones that we should be aiming to get back. For those patients who are arresting because of critical illness, their survival to discharge rate is between 2 and 10%. So a lot lower, and obviously, as you would expect, it's going to be lower because these patients have life-threatening illnesses anyway. Their organs are maybe failing, and this is why they're arresting. But overall, we will only improve these figures if we all perform CPR as effectively as we can, as regularly as we can when the need arises, so that we perform well as a team together, and that's how we'll achieve the best outcomes for our patients. So to summarise, if you recognise an arrest, then raise the alarm and start chest compressions whilst you're waiting for other people to arrive, who can then get a tube in, start IPPV, get an ECG on, get a capnograph on, and start giving drugs. And we want to give adrenaline and atropine every 3 to 5 minutes. And if you don't remember anything else, then remember to push hard and push fast, and that the best outcomes are going to be achieved with good quality chest compressions, good quality ventilation, and defibrillation if it's indicated, although thankfully that's in a relatively smallish proportion of cases. So thank you very much for listening, everybody, and I hope that that has helped you to improve your team efforts for CPR.
On behalf of Webinar Club, I'd like to thank Helen for a great presentation today. The recording and the certificate for this webinar will be available in the next few days in the members area of Webinar Club. Thank you all for attending. That's the end of the webinar.